When you were a child, how did people travel through rural Alaska?
I was born in 65, and it was right at that turning point between dog teams and snowmobiles. And it was a huge change, not just because snowmobiles go fast and you sit on them or whatever else, because dogs made our focus totally on the land, finding dog food, hunting with your dogs, feeding your dogs, and snowmobiles needed dollar bills. And so it sort of turned the culture inside out. And so people were doing both when I was a kid, and my family had both. But it was the turning point where, by and large, dogs went away, other than racing, which is a sport now.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from public radio members and Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with photographer and writer Seth Kantner about his collection of essays titled Swallowed by the Great Land. Tell us where you grew up. What kind of a place was it?
I grew up on the Kobuk River, which is about 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle in northern Alaska. I was 25 miles or so downriver from an Eskimo village. My family was. And we lived in a little sod igloo, which is a tunnel into a little cave, basically. As the years went on, we buried that tunnel and made sort of a door out of boards and caribou hides and added onto the place. And so it became more like a buried sod igloo cabin type of thing, still very rough. And in the ground, which meant lots of mice living with you and animals walking on the roof without knowing they were on a roof because it's moss and part of the hill. And really stormy, often long periods of time with no people, other people. Probably the most important part of every day, just animals showing up and hunting animals, wearing skins, running our dogs out to set traps and setting nets under the ice to get fish to feed the dogs. And so our whole existence was focused on gathering stuff from the land.
So just you and your parents and your brother, and you're out there miles and miles and miles, I think 25 miles from a grocery store probably. Was that about right?
I think the 25 miles from people was right, but there wasn't really a grocery store when you got to the people. Did have some, canned peaches and Butterfingers and fishing line and stuff like that.
And so everything that you ate as a family, you had to go out and harvest, whether it was an animal or a plant.
We did have flour and sugar and vanilla and, stray things like that, peanut butter and powdered milk. And as the years went on, more and more stuff, we started gardening and growing potatoes and stuff like that. But we ate majority protein, dried fish, regular fish, frozen meat, raw fish. Yeah.
The stories in this book are mostly about food.
I'm glad you mentioned food because I think it's kind of a fascinating tie to the land that people don't think of that often. And the way I was raised, we thought of food all the time. And it's we're always worried about our dog food pile, whether it's big enough to make it through the winter. And people food and dog food, that's what we call it, two different things. And so the caribou were the main source of meat, food, and most important animal to local people because we used the skins for mukluks and the caribou hides to sleep on and all the different bones for soup and the meat to dry and the sinew for thread. So caribou were the most important animal. And berries, we picked a lot of berries. We're always thinking about food, and it makes me wonder, when I go to Costco and see, like, there's still people focusing on food, but there's missing pieces in the connection.
Yeah, because they have no idea where the products on the shelves came from, how they went from a plant in a field to this plastic contained.
Yeah, I think there's certain missing connections and a lot of things. I was making a kayak up until a couple days ago when I came down here to Montana for my daughter. I was making a kayak, and it was a lot of work. And she was there, and she was waiting for her kayak. And the old one has a lot of bear holes, bear bites in it. And I was realizing that, you know, nowadays I could have bought her one, but there is a real difference between that connection of making your own snowshoes or kayak and picking your own berries. And it's, I guess it's a ton of work, but it provides some connection. And when I was a kid, we didn't have choices. We had, if you wanted a kayak, you made one. And if you wanted blueberries, there was no Costco.
These days, we all have jobs, so we can't go out and hunt our food and make our kayaks because we're too busy earning the money to go buy them ready-made.
Yeah, and I'm kind of caught in the middle at this point because that's probably the hardest thing about writing for me is I try to do both or more than both. I have lots of different jobs, and somewhere in there I try to write, which doesn't provide very much income. Pays for new boots and a little bit more, but and then when it comes time for a kayak, I still want to make my own. I can't not do that. I guess I'm trying to keep connections going that maybe are not part of our modern society or something. I still really want to pick my own cranberries and hunt my own meat. I'm trying to do it all, I guess, at this point.
Where is the town and the area that you live in, your family homestead? Where is it if people looked at a map of Alaska?
I think 350 miles northwest of Fairbanks, 100 miles above the Arctic Circle, on the Kobuk River, which flows along the south side of the Brooks Range, a couple hundred miles in from the Chukchi Coast, the Bering Straits there. So if you went up past Nome 100 miles and then turn left and went another couple hundred miles, turn right. I'm dyslexic. I just sent you to Russia.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Seth Kantner. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. mtpr.org is the place to listen on demand or sign up for our podcast. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Well, as we have been talking about, food has been a big focus of your life, and it's a big focus of the essays in this book. So let's hear an essay that has a lot of different kinds of food in it that I've never heard of, and it's called The Food Web.
Last summer, I helped Colleen Swan and her family till a garden and plant a raised bed garden box in Kivalina. Colleen has been getting more and more interested in growing food. Afterwards, her parents, Joe and Lona, invited me inside to eat lunch. It was hot and sunny. For a change, the wind was not blowing. I'd gotten a lot more mosquito bites than I ever expected to get in that village and had almost given in to offers of mosquito dope. I washed up and sat down at their table. The food was just what I hoped for. Coke, which is boiled walrus skin and blubber, and tukayuks, sea lovage, which is greens that people put in seal oil, and dried trout and dried ugruk, bearded seal, that is, otherwise known as black meat. I hadn't had walrus since my dad's friend, Orrin Knox, gave me some years ago. I pulled out my sheath knife and got quiet and busy. A few minutes later, I realized the other people at the table were cutting the hair off the skin. I shrugged and kept eating. I guess it's my upbringing. As kids, my brother and I weren't told to trim the hair off boiled caribou lips, beaver feet, or muskrat tails. We just went ahead and ate it. I glanced around again and realized a very cool thing. There wasn't any white man food on that table, not even a Lipton's tea bag. Here in Northwest Alaska, there's endless rhetoric about subsistence this and subsistence that, but generally you run into 1,000 variations of brightly packaged store-bought food, Wonder Bread and frozen pizza, Fig Newtons, hot dogs and Slim Jim jerky, Rock Stars and Red Bull, and all the rest. There was none of that on the Swan table. It was pretty reassuring to see. Gathering food and gathered food, for some reason, is close to my heart. Preparing food, caring for food, and sharing food. Traveling around Alaska and the lower 48, I'm finding there are a lot of people who feel more or less the same. The network in which food is shared is convoluted but satisfying. I'm a small part of it, and I enjoy and appreciate the way it connects us to each other and to the land. Recalling just the last few seasons, my mind fills with food trades. Last fall, I gave Ubi Green a bag of turnips and carrots I grew. He wouldn't let me leave his yard till he'd got me some bowhead muktuk from his shop. In Ambler, I gave Mary Williams caribou. She sent me downriver with fresh bread, seal oil, and punuktuk, which is dried caribou. Her son Alvin gave me a big hunk of bear meat and fat. Once you have rendered bear fat, you need tinnik berries to put in it. Erica Rogers in Tok, Alaska, picked a few cups and sent them U.S. priority mail to me. Meanwhile, I dried caribou to send to my parents in Hawaii. They sent what they grow, coffee beans, dried bananas, and mangoes. When a nice-looking caribou comes my way, I give Red Seaburger a quarter. On our table, we've always got jars of her beautiful okpek, that's salmon berry, okpek jelly and occasional nagoon berry jam. From down in Sitka, those black cod longliners, Linda and Kent and Jeff, they sent my daughter home from art camp with carefully collected halibut cheeks and black cod collars. Talk about splendid food from the sea. It took me a while, but I finally got a muskox hindquarter down to them in slight repayment. From down in Montana, my old journalism classmate's ex-boyfriend sends me potatoes from his farm, and I send him salmon. Over in Minnesota, my Chippewa friends, the Erdrich sisters, send me wild rice and dried apples. I return jarred salmon and salmon berries and dried caribou. There's a lot that goes into hunting and gathering and gardening, everything from hip boots to hunting knives, but somewhat less macho and I'd say more important is simply care, care for the food. Just before freeze-up last year, I got an extra fat caribou. I hung it for 2 days and then gave a hindquarter to Ubi. I pay a lot of attention to fat, of course, and aging the meat and keeping it clean and free of sand. I thought I was pretty cool giving him that perfect piece of meat. I tried to escape without him giving me anything. He wasn't about to be outdone. He led me into his spotless shop, opened an equally spotless freezer, and handed me 2-quart jars of black meat and seal oil. "You don't have to give me anything," I protested. He didn't comment, just handed me cold packets of vacuum-packed muktuk and then a Ziploc of smoked salmon strips. At home, I sat down to eat. When I opened the muktuk, I found it had been pre-sliced in 1-inch slabs. The strips of smoked salmon looked like they'd been cut with a laser, all exactly the same length. You could carry one of them for a ruler. I'm friends with Ubi's son, so I asked him about it. I found out his dad had been trained by the old reindeer herders, and he didn't allow even 1 caribou hair on his meat. I couldn't sleep that night. I'd been careful with that whole caribou, but I could guarantee there were some hairs on it, and I hadn't washed the turnips and carrots, or the ones I'd given him the previous fall. I'd had some kind of foolish pride, believing the dirt on them proved they were homegrown. That caribou hindquarter was what really kept me awake. I always put a lot of care into my caribou, but at the same time figure a stray hair or even 10 simply prove what kind of meat it is. We didn't have a freezer when I was a kid, so my family stored meat outside for the winter, still in the skins, for protection from the elements. As a result, even now, I'm not very talented at telling my Ziploc bags apart when pawing through a freezer. Frustrated, I started joking that I was going to keep bags of moose, muskox, and caribou hair handy to sprinkle on the meat, so there'd be no guessing and I could instantly tell a muskox roast from a moose roast or a caribou. Anyway, that encounter was a humbling lesson. The good part is I'm accustomed to it. There's been plenty over the years. Bob Yule couldn't believe I didn't know how to wrap fresh caribou meat in the skin and bury it in the snow in winter to age it, even when it's 30 below outside. I remember Clarence Wood watching me gut a caribou, shaking his head and gesturing, "Take it off other side, always be easier." This after he'd cleaned a caribou while wearing a dress shirt without getting a drop of blood on him, not even on his wrist near his shiny metal watch. I remember Carrie Yule being disgusted that I was picking blackberries too early before they were ripened to her standards. Here in Kotzebue, Red Seeberger's daily trips to the tundra to check the berry progress over the years also have showed me that I wasn't paying attention nearly as well as I thought.
This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Seth Kantner about his latest book, a collection of essays titled Swallowed by the Great Land.
I thought it was really interesting that your parents have fled the Arctic and now live in Hawaii, kind of the opposite climate.
It's funny, I do readings occasionally, and that's a laugh line that came as a surprise to me. People would say, "Oh, where are your parents now?" And I'd say Hawaii, and people always laugh. I guess moving from the Arctic straight to Kona or Captain Cook Hawaii is funny, but I will say that pretty quick in the process of living in a sort of subterranean cave, my mom grew very sick of it. No electricity, one window, no running water, lots of mice in the house, sleeping on skins. And my dad was out having an incredibly romantic life, running dog teams and hunting caribou and then crawling in the tunnel in the evening to drag meat and wood in. And sure, it was tough life for him too, but he was liking it more than my mom, stuck inside with two kids, babies, and inside being a cave, basically.
Oh, babies with no running water and no electricity.
Ugh. And no light.
No windows in that cage?
There was, but it would get buried.
Have you had conversations with people who are vegetarians, people who don't agree with eating animals or trapping animals? How do your conversations with them go?
I'm pretty comfortable with that. I trapped as a kid, and I love trapping. It's really exciting to see the footprints in the snow and see where they go, and to come around the trail and see if there's an animal in your trap. But then when you get to the trap and the animal's leg is totally mangled, frozen and splintered bones, and this animal's been suffering terribly for a long time. We try to check our traps every couple of days, but still. So when a vegetarian tells me they don't want to eat meat because of some reason, I don't have any problem talking to them about it or relating or understanding. I have run into vegetarians who like eat processed food, don't even eat vegetables, and that just I didn't know what to say. I can understand wanting to have really nice broccoli instead of caribou, but to have some packaged little thing with a wrapper on it, that probably was the hardest conversations for me to come up with anything to say besides, is coffee allowed?
Yeah, because the things in the package aren't even really food. I mean, they've had all of the nutrition processed out of them.
It seemed like it's kind of taking away from the idea of being a vegetarian. But, yeah, I'm not against that. And then, like I say, I grow whatever I can in the summer. But winter traditionally was a lot of protein. I think it's kind of interesting, too, the way, not to get off on too big of a sidetrack, but the American I don't know about medical establishment, but just common belief was that fat was bad for you. And I come from a culture that if you brought home skinny meat, any kind of skinny meat, skinny duck, skinny caribou, skinny bear, you were a disgusting person, way worse than any sort of time spent in jail or just pretty much anything else you could do. Getting skinny meat was the lowest form of person. And people live on a lot, have traditionally on tons of fat. And I'm very skinny, but I eat mostly I sit down every day and eat muktuk and seal oil and bear fat and endless amounts of cheese and butter. So when the, I started hearing more and more over the years after I grew up and bumped into white society more that fat is evil. It was, wait, what are you talking about? And I think that might be slowly changing.
Well, studies have just come out that prove that sugar is the thing that makes you fat, not fat, not eating.
Yeah, well, I grew up with a mom who's a health food fanatic, and she always thought sugar was the devil since I was, 2 years old. So anyway, trying to get off food, maybe we can talk about the weather or something.
Well, speaking of the weather, the title story, Swallowed by the Great Land, in this collection refers to what happened with a specific man who seemed like he should be able to take care of himself out there, but it didn't end up so well for him.
Yeah, the German survivalist guy from he had been in one of these survival schools in Wisconsin and came up there, met a friend of mine, and then went and was going to spend freeze up in the Arctic, 50 miles above the village there, and ended up disappearing. I just took his wife and another woman searching for him again this spring. It's been 4 years. And we found nothing again. But yeah, it's a big, hard, huge land up there. And nobody knows what he did wrong, but it's easy to do something wrong. I've been lucky, but I don't. Alaskans like to jump on outsiders and say, what a stupid fool, he should have known better. I don't know. He was alone. He didn't have a satellite phone or all this other airplanes and helicopters, whatever. A lot of the guys that were calling him a fool, tend to travel in large groups with lots of amenities. But it's easy to screw up and end up under the ice or something like that.
Well, it seems like once you're on the wrong side of a lot of water, you're really in trouble.
Yeah, well, not to get too complicated, but that particular fall was up in the Arctic where I'm at, we're having terrible effects of climate change. We're really the ground zero. And 10 years ago, I was maybe the one shouting about it. And now there's just like no non-believers at all. And I'm talking about, old Eskimos who have grown up totally on the land. They've all accepted it too because it's just so overwhelming. Our changes in weather, the ice, the trees, the willows, our brush is like over our head now when it used to be down around your ankles. Everything's changing so much. And so Mr. German dude came up there and happened to bump into what we're experiencing, which is really unsafe ice. And he didn't even really know about ice. And then, it was a very unsafe year, fall time, and lots of rain on top of the ice. And so it's hard to learn ice when ice is changing. Even the old-timers are drowning,
And you wrote a children's book.
Yeah, it's called Pup and Pokey. It was really challenging getting it published and then dealing with all that. It's been, I'll just say it's been pretty disappointing, the whole thing. It soured me on that, I guess. But working with the illustrator was really neat. And I don't know. Publishing a book is really challenging, and there's a lot of things that people who haven't done it, I guess, don't know about. One is like it kind of is out of your hands at a certain point, and like the cover, people say, oh, you chose an ugly cover. Well, as a writer, you don't get to choose a cover. And the same thing happens with I write columns for newspapers, and it comes out with a title on what you wrote, like Swallowed by the Great Land. That was a person at the newspaper came up with the head, it's called. And so I might write a story about running bear fat, and it comes out with a title that's incredibly embarrassing to me in the newspaper. And people think, well, that was pretty stupid of you. Well, you're not even the one who wrote it. You didn't even know. You didn't even get a voice in it. And so writing books has a lot of that takes place after you finally get your manuscript accepted. And I've had a real nice time working with the Mountaineers Books, who published Swallowed by the Great Land. And we just worked together on stuff because for a while it was a different title and a different cover. And I kind of complained and they listened and we worked together to change that. And that hasn't always been the case with my experiences with writing.
Well, I'm glad you found that relationship. What else do you want to say about the book?
I'm really dyslexic and terrible with computers. And so when it came time to to find these stories and put them together, I couldn't find them. And I had like the wrong versions where, you know, you save something when you're working on it, but then I forget to save the last one. So I had the old ones. And then eventually I sent it all to Mountaineers Books. They edited it. There was a lot more edits than I expected. And it was this Microsoft Word kind with the multicolors and the lines through and little words on the side. And so it was just like basically being in this blizzard of colors and words. And I hated every minute of it. I worked for 3 weeks with a pencil, accepting and rejecting edits, and then they wanted it copied before I mailed it from Kotzebue, and it was storming like heck. And I went outside to try to sneak it to the library to use the copy machine. There's no Kinko's in Kotzebue. And the manuscript slipped out of, under my arm, and pages went flying everywhere, and a lot of them went into my... Well, they disappeared in the dark. At that point, I was thinking I didn't want this book to be published. I was tired of it. The advance was microscopic, and the amount of work was a lot and everything. But when it came out, I like it, and I'm kind of picky about my stuff. I don't usually say I like what I did or admit it or something, but I like this little book. I like the stories, and I'm surprised. I even like title at this point.
So lots of trials and tribulations with your writing and publishing. Are you going to keep doing it?
I seem to be doing it, yeah. Ordinary Wolves took 12 years. I never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a trapper. You know, I went to college to find a girlfriend, not to, and took creative writing by accident. I didn't know what that meant. I just wanted an easy class. And that teacher sent me to Missoula to study writing, and then I decided I was going to write a book, and it took 12 years. I had no intention of ever writing another one. One was plenty. You know, when you get done building a house, do you say, oh, I got to build another one? Everybody says, build another house? Geez. Everybody started saying, write another book, and I was kind of horrified. But it's a little bit like a PhD, I think, where you spend 20 years learning how to write and getting your book published, and then what are you supposed to do? Go back to drying whitefish? So I kept trying to write, and it's super hard. I'm, you know, dyslexic. I can't spell. I can't think straight. I can't remember anything. I don't like sitting down. I can't stand being inside. Writing's not easy. But yeah, to answer your question, I guess I'm going to keep writing, yeah.
Seth Kantner lives in Northwest Alaska. Look for more information about him and his books and sign up for a podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. And thanks to you for listening and for your financial contribution. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.